This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hello, everybody from the board and members of the audience. I'd like to introduce a hero in the autism community, Allison Muatri. Again, it's Allison Muatri, who comes to us as an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of California at San Diego in the Division of Cellular and Molecular Medicine. His laboratory uses stem cells and various genetic tools to develop a better understanding of how the brain develops and what happens when development goes wrong and results in psychiatric disorders or mental disorders, the area in which I'm an advocate. He earned his PhD from the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. He has completed a postdoctoral fellowship across the street from his current institution at Salk Institute in the laboratory of Fred Gage. Again, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Dr. Allison Muatri. Give him a round of applause, please.
All right. Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here and share a little bit of my research with you guys. Thank you for the introduction. So my lab uses stem cells to model autism spectrum disorders, and most of you are probably very familiar with autism. Patients with autism, they have three major problems related to communication. They have difficulties with language, social interactions, and sometimes they're often trapped into a stereotype, repetitive, really focused behavior. It's a spectrum, which means that there are patients that are less severe and patients that are more severe. And we try to model using stem cell biology because it's a real problem. CDC estimates that we have 1% of the population with autism. If you're a male or a boy, you have higher chances to be diagnosed with autism. We really don't understand why this happens. Another major problem is that those kids, they will start the symptoms really early in life and they will continue to be adults with autism. So in a way, it's not only a pediatric disorder, but it carries through life. So the cost involved in autism is really high. And finally, what we know about autism is that there is a strong genetic predisposition, but it's not only genetics that contributes to autism, there is an environmental factor. We don't really understand, we're beginning to understand how these two factors interact with each other. And as you know, the major reason why I'm here, there is no cure for autism. And don't take me wrong, there are behavior therapies that if you have an early diagnostic, you can start with those therapies at these early stages, and then the clinical outcome could be a little bit better. But for most of the people, there is no cure, no drug that one can take and be cured from autism. So when I start doing disease modeling with stem cells, I came across with one of the biggest problems, which is to communicate what I do to the families with autism, because I would need those cells to start my own research. And the major obstacle was to explain what is a model. When scientists take words or concepts from the lay population, that's when the problem starts. So they are very familiar with stem cells, they are very familiar with autism, but model is a little bit tricky. And if you ask people what is a model, it's not unfrequently that I get this kind of response. And this is not wrong, this is actually a supermodel. If you ask a kid what is a model, it may give you a different perspective. You will say that this is a model of a train, and an engineer will say that this is a model of a flying machine. This is all correct answers. And I try to say that models are simplified representations of the reality. And the best models are the ones that you can increase in complexity to get closer and closer to the reality. So what's my reality? What I want to understand? This is the human brain. And there are current models to study the human brain. One is postmortem brain tissues, families that donate those tissues to science. And there are a couple of autistic brains out there. We can learn about the structure of those brain cells. But these are the endpoint of the disease. You already know that the person has autism and does not allow you to move forward with genetic manipulations or experimental biology. Blood cells are peripheral tissue that it's easily accessible, and we learn a lot about the genetics of autism. But these are not the relevant cell types. These are not brain cells. And also, I mean, blood cells do not make connections and do not form synapses. So that's a limitation right there. And finally, there are animal models. And animal models are also very limited. They're very important. We learn about circuitries in the brain. But a mouse brain is very different from a human brain. And in conditions such as autism, it's a very human condition. We are talking about the way we communicate, the way we look at each other. So this is very human specific. To translate from a mouse behavior is a little bit tricky. So when Yamanaka first introduced us to the concept of iPS cells, I immediately thought that one could use that to model autism. And I'm sure you are all familiar with this concept. One can reprogram somatic cells from a group of patients and a group of non-affected individuals, called here typicals or controls. We can generate those iPS cells. And from those stem cells, we can induce them to differentiate or to specialize into the relevant cell types. In the case of autism, we want to understand what happens in the brain cells, such as neurons and glia cells. And we compare and contrast those cells in the lab, so there is a controlled environment, and we look for differences. And the goal is to find differences and use those differences as a readout for drug screening, so we can screen drugs that may be able to revert or to rescue some of those cellular phenotypes that we call those differences between these two groups. One way to collect cells from patients that we found that was very efficient, fast, and non-invasive was to set up a social network. So we actually use Facebook to connect with the families, and we have what we call the Tooth Fairy Kit collection here. We send to the families a small cryo vial with a little bit of media, and we ask for the milk tooth. And from the milk tooth that arrives in the lab, we are able to isolate these dental pulp cells. And from there, we use as a source material to reprogram and to produce neurons. So this is how we do it. We have about 3,000 patients that are connected into this network. And we upload all the clinical information. So now we have a very rich material, a good cell bank where we can contrast cellular phenotypes in a dish to clinical phenotypes from the person. So we actually did that for some of the genetic diseases, and for the autism spectrum, we do see differences. Actually, when you differentiate the cells into neurons, at first glance, you don't see many differences, but if you zoom in those neuronal processes that these brain cells have, we start noticing that autistic-derived cells, they don't have as many protrusions or what we call neuronal spines, dendritic spines. Those are very dynamic, small structures that would be physically in touch to each other to form connections in the human brain. So there are differences between these spines, between the autistic group and the control group. Also, the number of synapses that they can form is also different. The number of connections, brain cells connections, is also different. We can do that in the lab. We can visualize that in the lab using several strategies. But the goal was to treat those cells with some experimental drugs and see if one can rescue or revert that. And we were lucky enough to see that there are some experimental drugs out there that can actually do that. So this is just one example. I will show you my favorite showcase, which is a neuron derived from Rett syndrome, perhaps the end of the spectrum, one of the most severe and dramatic situations of the autism spectrum. So as you can see, neurons derived from controls, they have much more synapses compared to Rett syndrome. But if you treat those neurons for 2 weeks with IGF-1, this is insulin growth factor 1, the number of synapses or the levels of synapses go up to the normal levels, to the control levels. At the functional level, I mean, if you could see these neurons talking to each other, and that's exactly what I have in those videos, it's clear that the autistic-derived neurons, they don't make as many connections as in the controls, but after drug treatments, they would behave exactly as normal or neurons derived from a non-affected individual. So this is all good, but we have another bottleneck, which is how to test drugs that are more relevant, perhaps repurposing drugs in the lab. At early days, this was very difficult. Having like a small lab with a limited number of people, we could screen only three drugs or one drug per year. But thanks to the early translation award, I was able to move that and collaborate with the really speed up the translational process, and we are in this writing this road right now. So, but the model, as I mentioned to you, we can increase the complexity of the model to get close to the human brain. And the human brain is not composed only by neurons. They are composed also by glia cells from Latin glue. Those are other cell types in the brain that makes the neurons connected to each other. And I would like to point out one cell type here, this green cell here. These are what we call astrocytes because they have these astro or star-shaped cells. And those astrocytes, what they do is they are in really close touch with neurons, but they are also in really close touch with blood vessels. From a therapeutic perspective, this is the first cell type that would be hitting your brain if you receive a drug. So astrocytes are really important. We derive astrocytes from patients with autism, and we test if those astrocytes can do what they do best, which is to communicate to other astrocytes. So what we have here is it's a monolayer of astrocytes, and the red circle here, it's one single cell type that we mechanically stimulate by just touching that cell type, and you can see that the signal in the different colors here are spread out to the other cell types. Basically, what these astrocytes are saying, there's something wrong here, let's communicate to the whole brain. They do it fast, that's what they do best. Look for cells that were derived from autistic patients. They are not even close. You can touch different parts of the plate, and they will never propagate that communication. So they have a lack of communication as well, similar to neurons. So now I show you that neurons are affected and astrocytes are affected. Can I put the two of them together and see how they react? So we started studying this interplay between these two cell types by proposing this type of experiment. We isolate neurons and we plate on top of the astrocytes, and we wait like for 2 or 3 weeks, and then we reanalyze those neurons to see how they look like. So this is how these cells look like in a dish. You have in the background red cells. These are the astrocytes, and we plate on top individual or a low density of neuronal cells here in green. And after 2 weeks, the neurons will develop really well because they are in contact with these astrocytes. And we can analyze several aspects of this neuronal morphology, including those protrusions that I mentioned to you in the past. So because we have a group of autistic and a group of controls with different genetic backgrounds, we can mix it up, those two cell types. And I'll show you just a summary, just a teaser of what we have in the lab. So if I plate normal neurons, neurons derived from non-affected individuals on top of astrocytes, this is what happens. Those neurons will develop really well. You can see this nice and long arborization. They will be full of spines. But if I now plate these normal neurons on top of astrocytes that were derived from people with autism, you don't see as many arborization. In fact, they look like very immature type of neuron, just bipolar. They don't have as many spines as they used to be. The same is true if you plate, if you co-culture autistic-derived neurons with autistic-derived astrocytes. They don't develop as well. But look at that. Look at this next data. If I now plate autistic-derived neurons on top of normal astrocytes, I basically rescue everything. So we can recover or rescue by just plating on top of a cell type that does not have any mutation that leads to autism. So genetics has not the last word here. So there is opportunities, therapeutic opportunities that one can explore via these other cell types to rest or to revert the condition. One thing that people from the families keep asking me when these drugs will be available, I often say that this is a very complex answer to give, and I like to show that because we can never underestimate what's going to happen like in the next 10 or so years. But this is a tricky question because it has lots of variables, including, including finding good sales, good people, and financial support as well. So I'll finish here by just thank people from my lab. So these are postdocs and students that come from all over the world to work on this specific project. Support, especially the early translation from CERM. This was really important for my lab to take off. And finally, to the patients and families. And I do have here the video from one mother from an autistic kid who participated in our research. And she has something to say.
Hello, my name is Jen. I have a 10-year-old son with autism. Milo was born in 2003 and diagnosed in 2005 as being on the spectrum. He's nonverbal, he's never spoken a word in his entire life. He's not self-injurious, he has his own special autism like they all do, which is why I think the stem cell research and treatment is so important for these kids. I look at my son a lot and feel like he's just trapped. He is trapped inside his own brain. Circuits are going crazy. He can't figure it out. Of course, I can't figure it out. And I believe that he deserves to have a voice. And right now he doesn't. I mean, they're making headway with iPads and such like that, but it's more than that. It's more than being able to say that, you know, I want a piece of bread. It's about saying how you feel and about who you love or who you like or whatever, those kind of things. And he's never said, I love you. He's never said, Mom, with any meaning. He's really sweet, you know, and I would just die to find out what's going on inside his brain. And I know that's never going to happen until he gets some type of stem cell treatment individualized for him. And I have so much hope in this field that it gets me so excited, you know, which is just the opposite from, you know, always crying about it. So I really support what you do. I wouldn't say our lives hang in the balance, but there's nothing that could be more important to me than being able to hear my son's voice and to know what he, you know, a month ago he had an emergency appendectomy. He must have been going around in pain for a couple of weeks and never once was able to express that. Don't even know if he knows what pain is or what. It was not until he was doubled over and we went to emergency that we figured out what was wrong. And that's just so, so hardcore to think of as a mom, your kid being in pain and them not being able to tell you. It's like, all the time. You're not going to understand a word. And that's kind of how I think his receptive learning is as well. He just like has, you know, hands over his ears, hands over his mouth, hands over his eyes, everything's blurred, nothing makes sense. So I can't express enough how important this research is. I mean, think about all these kids, these nonverbal kids, all these kids stuck in their brains. I think the whole world should just stop, hand you a bazillion dollars and get to work, you know, get the research done so it can be done safely. That's kind of our story in a nutshell. Again, my kid's wonderful, but he is trapped. And I never really knew how bad it was until I had my second son. And the conversations that we have, the connection that we have, I feel like I have been, you know, he has been stolen from me. I was given this body, but without the brain functioning, you know, and I will do anything to get that functioning again. Not again, he never had it, to get it functioning, period. But good luck with everything you do. I love what you guys do. I wish I would have stayed in school. I would have studied, you know, this. But anyways, I hope that this helps, and I hope one day to be giving you a video of Milo talking. All right, thank you, and have a very good day.
As you can see, when I talk to families and I ask what is the thing that has the most impact from this kind of research, they say is the ability to see that those neurons in a dish can be reverted back. Maybe one day this would be happening in their own brains. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, doctor, for a very clear and lucid presentation of the story and what you're doing. We really appreciate it. And of course, wish you all the best from the board and to all of the patients whom you hope to help with your research. Other comments? Dr. Trounson.
It's very nice work. I mean, we know each other quite well, and I really appreciate what your team's been doing. That's fantastic. There's a lot of interest in retrotransposons in these schizophrenia and in the autism disorders. Have you got any thoughts about the possibility that these retrotransposons are playing a part, and where they may play that role?
Yeah. So right now we have a nice correlation when we study brains from postmortem brain tissues derived from this population. And we do see an increase in retrotransposition. And for those who are not familiar with these are mobile pieces of DNA that may cause some structural changes or also gene expression changes somatically only in the brain that will never be detected in blood. And the fact that we see this increase in several mental disorders last year, a group from Japan nicely demonstrate that this happens in schizophrenia, opens this possibility that we never thought about it, that somatic alterations are happening in the brains. And we have no idea how this happens, why this happens. This is such a new field. But I strongly feel that the contribution is there. Somehow they do contribute to the disease.
Dr. Dulige.
So again, on behalf of the room and on the phone, thank you so much for such a wonderful presentation. The way you've explained the basic science and the potential of hope is really awesome. And most importantly, your research with one of your team is absolutely incredible. If you can thank on our behalf also this mother for her courage, and I'm sure it was very emotional for her to do that, and we really appreciate it. My question is, as you try to elucidate really the role astrocytes, what's your next step, what's your dream step after that that would get closer to a potential clinical trial or experimental effort?
Yeah, so we decided to move forward in both fronts, testing new drugs in neurons and in astrocytes and putting them together as well. So this is what we are currently doing. We do have some candidates that help us to increase synaptogenesis in neurons. And we are testing now with the NIH on astrocytes as well. So the hope is to find what are the best molecules to move forward. That's why I think this step is so important. And this is where my lab lack experience and also support to give this first step into clinical trials. Of course, we want to understand what these drugs does. But one of the first libraries that we test, these are repurposing drugs. So they already pass toxicology problems, and they're clean. So eventually we could start right away. So that's our goal right now.
Mr. Allen.
Again, as the patient advocate for people with psychiatric disabilities or mental health, first let me acknowledge the simplicity of the presentation underscores how hopeful it was. It provides people with a sense that there is recovery from this disease called autism, and that recovery and wellness are correlated and even has implications for people with psychiatric disabilities other than autism, like schizophrenia, which for most people in the mental health community is deemed incurable. And so, again, I want to ditto what's been said. Thank you very much. It was heartwarming, and you tell that mom I said thank you very much as well, personally. Thank you.
Other comments? Okay, well, thank you, Doctor, again, for a very, very interesting presentation. Best of luck going forward.
All right. Thank you, guys. Thank you all for the support.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.